Pat Frank, who wrote the famous satire of our time, Mr. Adam, is the author of a new book. It's entitled An Affair of State. And this afternoon, he meets critics Richard Gaiman and James Michener. And now, meet the man who keeps the peace on this program, your regular chairman, John K. M. McCaffrey.
Good afternoon, everyone. The author this afternoon wrote the unforgettable Mr. Adam, the story which delighted millions of Americans. Newsweek magazine called Mr. Adam an extremely funny story written by an extremely serious man. This serious man sits next to me this afternoon, determined to meet his critics in a battle about his new book, An Affair of State. And here, with a brief summary of the story, is our author of the afternoon, Mr. Pat Frank.
In writing this book, I had, I think, three themes. In the first place, I wanted to show the futility of war. It's not hard to do. In the second place, I wanted to show the effect that one man in the Department of State, one Foreign Service officer, could have upon your lives. And finally, I attempted to show that we can't preach democracy abroad without practicing it at home. Now, this is a story of a young guy who goes to Budapest as a member of the Foreign Service. And he is immediately plunged into the Cold War. And he does as well as he can for his country. He finds out certain things that aren't in the book. He reports them back home. He is not believed. And he is fired out of the Foreign Service. I think I resolve it happily eventually, but it's a rather tough tale.
Well, now, Mr. Frank, first meet the man who was so unkind to you in the Saturday Review of Literature and who, we hope, will be just as blunt when he meets you face to face, Mr. Richard Gaiman.
I thought Pat Frank's first novel, Mr. Adam, was a very good idea, and I enjoyed it with certain reservations. I was looking forward to reading An Affair of State, but I found that one rather disappointing. The basic idea is good and manages to hold the reader's interest, just as a story in a confession magazine does. But the book itself is as full of cliches as a speech by a presidential candidate. The situations, the characters, and the writers are all tired and deadeningly familiar. But that is my principal objection. Ordinarily, I don't suppose it's valid to criticize a work of the imagination on political grounds, but since Mr. Frank has obviously thrown away all artistic considerations, an exception might be made in his case. I object to the book mainly because it presupposes a war with Russia. I don't happen to believe that there is going to be a war with Russia. Despite the efforts of certain congressmen, everybody in this country is still entitled to his own opinion. But I wonder if Mr. Frank's opinion isn't irresponsible or considered and possibly dangerous at this time. By implying a war with our former ally is certain, An Affair of State can only contribute further to the hysteria which seems to hold the country in its grip today.
Now, our other critic is an old friend of ours, Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist, author of Tales of the South Pacific, a man to whom I am very grateful for doing a magnificent job as moderator a few weeks ago, Mr. James Michener.
I like Pat Frank's novel, An Affair of State, for six good reasons. One, it is an engrossing, swiftly moving story. Two, it is filled with delightful humor, humor of a very high quality. Three, the humor is not wasted. It is directed against terribly important targets, I might add, targets that need to be laughed at by all Americans and often. Four, the book deals with our Department of State in so factual and inside-the-scenes manner that it will add to anyone's knowledge of this increasingly important function of our government. Five, the book has some vital observations to make about the folly of placing worn-out admirals and generals in charge of diplomatic missions which require the ultimate in tact. Again, let me explain that he does not appear to be taking a crack at General Marshall. Like most of us, Pat Franks welcomes good generals and admirals used where they can do the most good. But he is afraid when bad admirals and bad generals are placed where they can do the most damage. And any GI will assure you that there is practically no limit to the damage a dumb general can inflict. Six, the book has made some very sensible guesses about Russia. Now, I feel that any writer who can accomplish even one of the above six feats is worthy of our respect. Now, since I'm a writer, I'll explain what I mean by respect there. I mean go out and buy his book. Don't borrow some friend's copy. But Pat Frank has done all six things. That adds up to a real accomplishment. And I'm proud to be able to defend the book this afternoon.
Well, now, Mr. Gaiman, would you like to put Mr. Pat Frank's six feats right back in Mr. Michener's mouth?
First of all, I'd like to know what Mr. Michener means by a good admiral or a bad admiral.
I mean this, that an admiral may be an excellent man in charge of a battleship where doggedness and an absolute unwillingness to face any facts but victory are concerned. But place that same man in charge of a delicate international mission, and I simply think he's off base. He's out of his depth, and I think the State Department's putting admirals and generals in charge of diplomatic missions is about as sensible as putting Mickey Rooney in charge of a girls' finishing school. They just don't go together.
There may be more sense in putting Mickey Rooney in charge of a girls' finishing school than you imply.
Well, it would help toward the finish, I imagine, but go ahead, Mr. Gaiman.
It seems to me that at several points in the book, everyone seems to look toward a war with Russia as not only a possibility, but a probability. And I certainly don't see that that's valid. In the first place, I'm reminded of something that happened just the day before yesterday. I think the fault does not entirely lie with the admirals. Well, I think all admirals are bad admirals. I don't think there's any such thing as a good admiral, except on a battleship. But over the weekend, or over the Friday, I believe it was, Russia made a very important concession in the matter of international control of atomic energy. This was greeted with loud sighs of despair from our own representative in the UN. He said he felt that they weren't sincere about it. He felt that it was just a dodge and so forth. This seems to me to be the kind of attitude that Mr. Frank advocated.
Mr. Frank, you can't say a word.
This seems like just going around in a circle to me. Here, Mr. Gaiman castigates Mr. Frank's book because all the stupid people in Mr. Frank's book assume that war with Russia is around the corner. All the stupid people I know assume that. And yet the whole point of Frank's book is that that isn't necessarily the only point of view. And yet to prove the folly of this, Mr. Gaiman cites the fact that when Russia comes forward with a logical proposal, stupid people everywhere say they must be faking, they can't go on. Seems to me he's proved Mr. Frank's point right with his own citation.
Well, at one point in the book, in the first meeting of Jeff Baker, the protagonist, with the admiral and with this man Keller from the State Department, they're talking about the coming war. What do you think of it, they say. I think it's thrilling, says Baker. And there are many other instances throughout the book where you have a feeling that Baker would not be too unhappy if a war came. I don't believe that he would enjoy the idea of going back to combat, since he obviously had such a bad experience in combat.
Oh, now,
at the same time, they take for granted that there's
no.
Going
now,
to be
wait
war.
A minute. Wait a minute. You certainly have read enough books, Mr. Gaiman, to know that an artist writing a book, and I think Pat Frank in this book has been an artist, sets out to put in the book certain characters who represent the very thing he's fighting against.
I think that's true, but they all suppose this. Would it not have been better?
Well, now let's go
on.
Would
it not have been better if he had said, for example, we can do something to prevent a war?
All right, now here you have in the book a young man, Jeff Baker, who has grown up in the traditions of the State Department, is deeply ingrained in him. He even looks like one of the particular type of State Department men that I happen not to like. And yet the man is thrown into a delicate international situation where he gives up one, a chance of marrying the girl he loves. He gives up two, his father's reputation. He gives up three, his chance at living among the friends who graduated from the same college he did. He gives up four, a chance to sneak out of a dirty situation through the back door. And he says, no, I won't do that. This problem of a war with Russia is too big. I'll throw the General Marshal's request for my resignation right back in his face, and we'll fight this thing out right in the public newspapers. Now, when a man does that, maybe he's doing it for some reason that I don't know, but it seems to me the simple thing to say is that he dreads war with Russia so much that he'll do anything, even sacrifice his own career, to prevent it.
I feel that the best way to dread war with Russia is to not even think about it, to see what we can do in a constructive way, rather
well, isn't
than...
It, isn't it true, Mr. Yeah. Gaiman, that the villain in the book is Gerald Mattson, the State Department man, who does assume that war with Russia is inevitable and prepares for it?
Yes,
and isn't he the chief villain of the book?
That is true, yes.
I may say that... very few books in that I've read recently do so neat a job in so few words on so vile a character as Frank does with Gerald Mattson, who through his society mad wife and the hangers-on that he married to give himself a name, he betrays his own country. It must be happening every day. There must be hundreds of men in the State Department who would rather drink tea correctly with the third-rate official of some South Pacific island who happened to go to Oxford than he would be to battle out the fundamental problems of his country. And I'm on Frank's side when he handles Mattson that
way. Well, now, Mr. Gaiman and Mr. Michener, I have only one alternative, and that is to put Mr. Frank in a straitjacket or to let him talk. And since I don't have a straitjacket handy, although it's a usual accoutrement of this program, Mr. Frank, do you want to reply to Mr. Gaiman?
Yes, I certainly do. In the first place, Mr. Gaiman says, I presuppose war with Russia. Of course, that's a lot of hooey. My book, I hope, gives us a way out from war with Russia. We must find a way. If we have war with Russia, why, we will have utter and complete disaster. I think that Mr. Gaiman hasn't said anything yet about the main premise of the book, which is that nobody ever again will win a war. I'd like to see what he has to say about it.
Well, I certainly agree with that. I was fairly close to the atomic bomb during the war. I spent 2.5 years in Oak Ridge, and I realized that, which is all the more reason why I believe that it's dangerous to presuppose a war. But what is this way out that Jeff Baker gives us? I see no way out.
It's a very simple way out, Mr. Gaiman. It's merely that the Soviet government overthrow its present leaders and install a government that will be as interested in peace as we are.
You feel, then, that the present Soviet government isn't interested in peace?
No, I think from the events of the last 2 weeks, why they're moving closer and closer to war.
I suppose I could put myself on J. Parnell Thomas's list and take the party line by quoting the various things we've done in the past few years, which all match Russia's actions, as showing that we aren't particularly interested in peace. But since I suppose as a man who doesn't believe in war, I will be clapped in irons at the time that war comes, before it comes, I won't even bother to do that. But we have been guilty of just as many international acts of aggression as Russia has.
But here we're talking about a book, Mr. Gaiman. A book of so and so many pages between covers. And it doesn't matter what Pat Frank here sits on my left says he wanted to do. And it doesn't matter what you say he didn't do. Let's see what he did do. You talk about the tired characters. And I think you make a fairly good point there.
All right.
But these tired characters that he has in this book are the tired characters of our nation who are running things in the same drudging old way. You get it with Keller. You get it with certainly Admiral Blankenhorn. You get it with Morgan Collingwood. You certainly get it with Gerald Mattson. Tired old men, worn out cliches, if you will. They're literary cliches. They're economical, political, and moral cliches. And I don't like my future in the hands of such men. And if Pat Frank has identified them as worn out old characters, I think that's a literary accomplishment.
Well, now, just a minute. It seems to me that everyone here, except Mr. Gaiman, has assumed that Mr. Frank has
a solution here. Well, as a matter of fact, I don't think there's any solution of this problem in the book at all. All we have is that there is a group of Russians who will try to rebel against their government, and that a radio has been established to tell the Russian people about how bad their government is. Now, that this is a solution outside of the covers of a fairly thrilling book, Mr. Michener.
But there's one delicate line in this book which hit me right between the eyes when Frank saw just such a comment as you're making, in which he said, "I know this sounds silly. It must sound fantastic to anybody listening to it. But how much more silly was the brutal fact that in Nazi Germany, a dictatorship of similar quality, a group of men high in the echelon came within 2 feet of killing Hitler. That bowls me over. In the cruelest, harshest dictatorship."
Jim, may I interrupt?
They didn't kill him.
And,
the important thing.
And
they
I
tried.
Might also say
they
that
tried.
The monolithic Japanese empire, which nobody thought they could penetrate, nobody could surrender. No Japanese could surrender. Eventually, they surrendered to political warfare, to propaganda, more than the atomic bomb.
May I make one point about this book? I think Pat Frank is guilty here of doing a very admirable thing. He's gone way out on a limb, making hundreds of guesses in this book. There's an awful lot in this. You may not like the story. When you're through with it, he said a lot. For example, one line caught my fancy. I read fairly carefully when I read for a job like this. And I try to figure out what the guy was driving at, and half the time I miss it. He had one line in there which I didn't understand until this morning. He pointed out that uranium for the atom bomb is now one of the crucial items in the world. And he said that this book is laid in the future, and he has an uprising in the Belgian Congo because our attitude toward race has been broadcast by somebody, presumably the Russians, to the Belgian Congo Negro workers, and they are in rebellion. And I thought, what a fantastic thing this guy is putting in here. Just a bit of horseplay. And this morning on the front page of the New York Times, what do you find? The Congo yields a new uranium ore, vanadium. And it goes on to say that the Congo deposit is now perhaps as important as the Canadian deposit. Now, this book must have been written 6 months ago.
But that
it was written a long time ago, before that.
Yeah, but the idea of identifying the current problems in terms of common sense seems to me good writing, if you're writing a book on current problems.
Did you get
it? I like that. Well, I think that's a very valid point, and there's actually no answer to it, except... I like my books to to admit the possibility that there won't be a war with Russia, and I hate to keep harping on this, but from
well,
the very
Mr.
beginning,
Gannon, may I interrupt a minute? I think my book not only admits that there won't be a war with Russia, but it shows a way that you can't have a war with Russia.
I don't see.
Well,
how.
I still
We've
don't see what this way is,
that,
Mr. Frank.
You don't. Okay,
I do. What is the way? Tell me then. I didn't get it in the
very book. Quickly. We did not believe that there would be competition against the Nazi hierarchy.
But that competition did no good, if I may.
Oh, if you come within 2 feet of killing a dictator, in the presence of all the concentrated might that a dictatorship can put together, it seems to me to bespeak a physical and human courage, which I simply don't have.
Gentlemen,
wait a minute. Whoa, we didn't think that we would have, in April of 1945, which we did have, a plot by the Emperor of Japan to surrender. But that was true.
Gentlemen, are you seriously suggesting that relations between the United States and the Soviet Union would be considerably improved with the assassination of Stalin? Is
no,
that what you
I'm
are suggesting that this way out for Mr. That Mr.
No,
Frank
I'm
is?
Assuming
no, but
from
I...
this book that Frank has pointed out that honest, hardworking men in America willing to take a risk, and honest, hard-working men in Russia willing to take a risk may work out the alternative to
war.
But
you're predicating it all on a small underground organization. Why don't we get our State Department people to do
it? What do you mean a small underground organization? Well, the thousands of Russians have deserted the Red Army in the last few months.
No, but now let's keep to the book, though. Here there is a solution within the book. In which he
the
says...
The assassination of Stalin.
No, wait
That's
a
what
minute,
you were
no.
talking about.
Oh,
exactly. You keep talking about the Hitler plots. That's what you're advocating.
No, but I'm pointing out that in this book you have one man willing, in the State Department, willing to risk his neck. And where does he go to get final backing up? Not to some third-rate flunky in Budapest. He takes it right
to
the
second. He did go to a third-rate flunky. Third,
all right. And he gets rebuffed there, and he goes, and what happens when Frank has the Secretary of State of the United States look over this deal with the boy whom he's got to fire? You have the feeling that the Secretary is just praying with all his strength that the boy may be correct and that this might be happening. No proof is forthcoming. The Secretary has to fire him. But you don't have in the highest echelon of the State Department, as Frank writes this book, a complete booby. You have a man just like the man who should be there. Somebody who's willing to take a chance, wants peace, wants to work things out. I think that's a good solution.
Well, it's hardly revolutionary or new, and why is it any more of a solution than the man that we have in the State Department now, General Marshall, who also has a solution. It's called the Marshall Plan.
There is a delicate point in this book as to whether or not the outstandingly excellent portrait of the Secretary of State is intended to be General Marshall. I don't think Pat Frank ought to answer that question.
Well, I'll answer it. I'm not afraid. It's part Marshall, it's part Hull, and it's part Wells. And I covered the State Department when Hull and Wells were Secretary of State and Acting Secretary of State. And I know a little bit about General Marshall, and it's a composite story. Like most characters, it's composite.
Well, now tell me this, Mr. Michener and Mr. Frank. You have given in the book a tremendous indictment of the State Department and have portrayed it to us as an octopus which has grown and now has tremendous power, which is not responsible really in any way to the people. It is responsible only to the State Department, as you present it. Do you believe that this is a true portrait of the State Department?
Well, yes, sir. I sure do.
Mr. Michener.
Yes,
Well, how did this happen, then?
I'm recommending this book for general reading because of the portrait of the State Department. Now, whether Pat Frank has gone too far or not, I don't know. He knows about that. I don't. I do know that I've seen the State Department on many levels and in many parts of the world. And the difference between a good officer and one of the striped ties and tails boys is so great that any amount of ridicule that Frank can pour upon the latter is not enough when you're talking about the paid moral representatives of this immense and great country. You have no idea what a false step on the part of these aristocratic 18th century looking men can do. Yeah, but then I think that needs to be nominated again and again.
Well, Mr.
There's
Gaiman,
only one really bad State Department character in the book, and that's Matson. First of all, the Admiral.
Well, Keller is no rogue.
Well, Keller is, maybe he might be a rogue.
But I believe Keller is if it's possible to use the word, at least serious about his job. He, of course, is sorry that the Atlantis project is going to fall apart because it will mean less personal glory. But well, at the same time, he would like to see it go through, and I think it's possible to use people like, or that it's possible people like that can do good things, whether they're roses or not. But on the other hand, the other characters and around the office there in Budapest are primarily fairly sympathetic people. There's Quigley, for example, and Quincy, whatever
Quincy
his name
Todd,
is. They seem to be good men. And actually, there is only one bad State Department character, and that's Matson.
Well, what about the Admiral?
He isn't a State Department man. He's an Admiral.
Well, that's exactly what I was getting at. The trouble with our State Department is that there are too many admirals and too many generals running the Department of State.
Now then, we're veering around here from a book that was extremely critical of the State Department. Now we're beginning to feel sorry for the State Department and say that it's the people outside the Admiral.
I really do.
Mr. Michener.
I don't know whether I put it in my book or not, but there's a saying in Washington that the last surrender of the war was to the Department of State to the Department of the Army.
Yes.
Now, Mr. McCaffrey, there's one point about this book that I don't want to overlook. Mr. Frank has a reputation of being an excellent humorist, and there are some wonderful humorous touches in this book. For example, and the point I want to make is that there are humorous touches applied to important things, which is the acme of humor. The admiral calls in the young hero of the book to give him the devil, and the boy finds the admiral on the floor, and the admiral says, "Watch out where you put your feet," and the admiral's playing with lead ships. And the boy sees that the American fleet, which is about to attack the Russian fleet, isn't much bigger than the Russian fleet. And he says, "Where did the Russians get all those battleships and carriers, Admiral? I thought they had only one or two." And the admiral says, "Oh, they've taken over the British fleet. The British are socialists, aren't they?" I mean, that sort of writing occurs all through. But here's an
It doesn't occur all through. It's in there in a few spots.
Well, let me hit another one. Let me hit another one. The admiral says, "All right, now you're the admiral of the American fleet. How are you going to get your team out of this tight spot that we Russians have you in?" The boy looks it over and says, "Well, the only thing to do, Admiral, is to turn your ships around like mad, sail them back to Africa, launch a lot of B-29s with atom bombs, and blow the Russian fleet to smithereens." And the admiral says, "Oh, that's not fair." And the boy says, "Well, we've got atom bombs, haven't we?" And the admiral says, "Yes, but I never use atom bombs in these problems." The boy says, "Well, why not?" And the admiral says, "It spoils all the fun." Well, that's what you want to hit at.
But that isn't humor. That's just reporting. You have only to read any admiral's speech to understand that they feel that way.
You don't think that's funny, Mr. Gannon?
Oh, I think it's dreadfully frightening for God.
I would agree.
But I don't
Mr.
believe
Gabriel.
It's humor. I believe that you can just read any admiral's speech. While we're quoting from the book, I have a few things that I'd like to read, if I may, Mr.
McCaffrey. Yes, Mr. Gannon.
Mr. Frank's handling of the girls is unsurpassed, except possibly in the Women's Home Companion. We see Susan, the main female character, for the second time, and I'd like to read this passage here. She seemed different. It wasn't her dress alone. She wore a white blouse with a gold pin at the shoulder and a black ballet skirt that seemed to possess rhythm of its own and that eddied and swirled with her smallest movement. As she moved to the teak bar, he noticed that her hair was different. It was loose and smooth like dark velvet brushing her shoulders. If anybody can find more cliches than that in one single paragraph in a recent contemporary novel,
okay,
I'd like to
now,
see
now, just a minute, Mr. Gaiman. But what she did later wasn't a cliche, was it?
No, it wasn't, but we can't discuss that on the radio. It's very common, yes.
Even the description sort of makes me more interested in this book. I don't believe I got that part.
Well, one other thing
yes, Mr. Gaiman.
I wanted to ask was, every week it seems to me J.B. Lippincott sends me all its mail. I get at least 18 letters from Lippincott every morning. It wasn't until a long time ago I discovered that their mimeographing machine had stopped, and so I get the same letter over and over again because it was stuck. And I read in one of these interminable dispatches from Lippincott that Mr. Frank had spent 2 months in the first chapter of the book, first 60 pages, I believe it was, and then 6 months on the rest. Now, I'd like to know how he can write a book of 254 pages, roughly that, in such a short period of time. It seems to me if he was really sincere about the book, he would have spent a lot more time on it.
Now, just a minute. You say I spent how long?
I'm just saying what Lippincott told me.
I see. Well, and altogether 6 months on the book.
Mm-hmm. Well,
may I interrupt? I don't think it makes a bit of difference whether you spend 10 years on a book.
But it might have been a better book if you'd have spent 10 years.
You can also turn out a stinker in 10 years.
May I come back to the book again and again? It says here specifically that it took 4 months to write the first four chapters and 2 months to write the next 12.
And how many chapters are there?
Well, I had 6 months.
Well, at least, gentlemen, we can promise all of our listeners a very pleasant hour or so with Pat Frank's book, and that's the important thing. I am sorry that time's up for everybody. And here is Bob Sherry to tell you what lies ahead on The Author Meets the Critics.
Mayor O'Dwyer has designated October 16th as Sweetest Day, a day on which to make someone happy. As a matter of fact, the Citizens Committee has already designated the sweetest creature of the year because of the happiness and peace which this creature has propagated among mankind. The creature is the Shmoo, a creation of Al Capp of Lil Abner fame. Al Capp asked to defend the Shmoo on The Author Meets the Critics, and we're delighted that he's going to be with us next week as he meets critics of the Shmoo face to face. The subject of the comics in general is bound to be raised, and we hope you'll join us next week as Al Capp meets his critics. And now back to John McCaffrey.
Before closing, I'd like to thank Pat Frank for coming here today to discuss his new book, An Affair of State,
and to thank you, Richard Gaiman, and you, James Michener, for coming here to discuss it with him. This is John McCaffrey saying good afternoon for The Author Meets the Critics.
The Author Meets the Critics is produced by Martin Stone, directed by Walter Law. This is Bob Sherry speaking. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.